Here at Step Brewers, we have a massive appreciation for those brewers in Australia paving the way in mixed culture, wild, and dare we use the word, sour beers.
We wanted to dedicate a series of episodes to those brewers and partner with the best in the game. So, we are extremely pleased to announce the new series as presented by Carwin Cellars, Time in Barrel. Hello there. Welcome to episode 46 of the Step Brewers podcast. It is me, your lager lover.
Lager lover?
Yeah.
That's new.
When did this happen?
It's very new news.
Wow, this is a hot take. Let's get this on the gram
definitely,
immediately.
Definitely got around some trimmer pills on the weekend. Oof. At the bottle share. So I'm now your lager lover.
You're not Ali. A juice wolf anymore.
It's sort of my second job to be the juice wolf now. I'm now known as lager lover, so please and thank you.
You do know how to slow pour. I've noticed that now.
Yeah, I do like Whippy Boys. You can just call me Whippy Boy. Who knows? I've got so many names.
Mr. Whippy Boy.
Joining me, of course, is written on the run sheet Papa Worldwide, also known as Klimt. Klimpert, K-Love, just as many names as me. Welcome.
Many names. Thank you. Thank you, Lager Lover.
Thank you for calling me my correct name. And also joining me is Captain Ahab, Ian. Just the simple name. Love it.
Yeah. Whale Boy. Well, boy, that's interesting. Hello, it's good to be here. Thank you, Alistair.
Oh, full name. Do not ever repeat that.
It's I respect you.
Oh, I hate my full name. I don't know. It's fine.
It's fine? I believe you. Tell me one more time.
No. Our next guest is the brewer and co-founder behind, arguably to us, Australia's best brewery. Housing an old warehouse in Marrickville, New South Wales. Their space is a wonderland for beer lovers and fans of mixed fermentation, as well as providing a house for their extensive barrels from which they blend some of the best beer in Australia.
Damn straight.
So welcome to the Step Brewers podcast, Topher from Wildflower. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. That's very, very nice thing to say. So thank you very much about what we do.
So stoked.
Quite humbling. So where do we go from here? So we're done?
That's it for the episode.
Yeah.
We're actually done. That's all we really do here. We occupy 5 minutes of your time and then we piss off. Yeah. Cool. No, so we'll actually start with what we're drinking. It's a fan favorite section. It really isn't. We just like to talk about what we're drinking on the show.
Also a good chance to crack a little beer.
Yeah. So we're actually drinking your collaboration. So the Wildflower and Mountain Culture collab, Family Fueled,
nice.
The Saison. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, firstly, thank you so much again for having me on the show. I'm looking forward to chatting and seeing what y'all want to ask about, and I'll do my best to answer all the questions, but also, I don't know, drop y'all in on some information as to what's going on for us. So it's kind of nice every once in a while to sit down and take stock, and this would be a good chance to do that. So thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Firstly, thank you for being here.
Welcome. More than welcome.
Yeah, so DJ and Harriet McCready have been friends of ours, so my wife and I, for God, a long time. I actually met DJ on one of the first weekends that Modus was open. So DJ came out to Australia to start that brewery, the Modus Operandi. And I was at the time the brewer at Batch Brewing Company down in Sydney, in Marrickville as well. And I went up to go meet him, and it was a big party. And anyway, we met then and have sort of continued to party and share many drinks over many, many occasions across different countries and continents and everywhere. So they've been really good friends of mine. And now my wife and Harriet get along really well. So they've just been close friends for a really, really long time. And so when they finally were able to put down roots and start their own brewery, not only was I stoked, it was within driving distance and not like super far away, because they had some dreams about starting a brew pub in Slovenia. There was talk about something going on in Brunei or something. I can't remember. There was some bizarre brewing opportunities heading their way. And anyway, they landed in the Blue Mountains, as we know. And I guess everyone knows now because they're like super popular.
Doing very well. Yes.
you know that DJ's sneaking up on you on the Untappd Best Brewer in Australia charts, right? He's number two to your number one.
Oh really? Oh god. I'll have to make some better beer. I don't know what to say. All right. I'll get on there and just like troll him and just give him 1-star reviews and stuff.
That's what you got.
He'd probably do the same. Yeah, that's a really good thing.
It just makes sense. Yeah. That's a solid marketing strategy.
You could exactly. Literally say not my style because it would totally not be your style.
Yeah. I mean, in fairness, like if I'm at home when I'm drinking a beer, it's a lot of the time one of their beers, because I do really like this beer.
Pretty fucking good.
It's pretty good, yeah. The Status Quo particularly, I just love someone making, a hazy, sort of full-bodied, really flavorful, like hot flavorful beer, but on the regular, you know? Like he's not trying to, I mean, obviously he does all the one-offs and stuff like that, but... Mm-hmm. For me, like pound for pound, that's just excellent. Like, you know, I mean, of course, one-offs are fun and they get always excited, but far out consistency on that is incredible. So I love that. Anyway, that diverged. So when they got up and running, we were recording, just chatting here and there and kind of decided we should do something together. And I think a style that's close to both of our hearts is, you know, probably more in my backyard as it would look right now. But when DJ opened Motors, they had 3 Saisons on tap. That was their opening lineup when they first opened the doors.
You would not think that now, or even like the beers he would subsequently make there, like former tenant, etc.
Yeah. I think that was actually part of the initial lineup as well, Tenet. But yeah, when the first time they poured their beers, there were 3 Saisons on the tap, and so DJ's always had a penchant for Belgian beer, and when he and Harriet were in Belgium, was able to hook them up with some friends there, and they got to visit heaps more breweries that I didn't even get to visit, so I'm pretty jealous of that. But anyway, we decided to make a Saison because we know that they're super marketable, and the market is dying for Saison. And every brewery that puts Saison on their can just sells them out immediately. And none of that's the case.
A much younger host on this show, and younger, I say maybe 6 or more months ago, said Saisons are dead, aren't they?
Yeah.
Season more months ago, man. It was like in our first year.
Was it a year ago?
It was a long fucking time ago now.
You never lived it down because now you love them.
I admittedly loved them then as well.
Yeah. I mean, it was a tough style. So we wanted to make something that we think could, you know, call it. We would certainly call it a Saison, but maybe also give people an idea that not all Saisons are the same, and make something that's, you know, both. Maybe something that is pretty traditional, to be honest, in how we made that beer, using local malt, Bluestone yeast, so yeast from Melbourne, a Belgian origin strain, and fermented it open in one of our vessels. Now, open fermentation, not necessarily like spontaneous. We inoculated, but it didn't have any pressure on it. And yeah, I mean, for me, a 4.5% beer drinks like way above that in terms of its mouthfeel and body. It's just super refreshing. I've regrettably don't have any left.
Well, this one was actually a little more tricky for us to obtain. Now, it's quite hard, if you'd even believe this, for us to obtain Mountain Culture down in Hobart. So we've had some sent to us from the Kings of the North, Poor Lord James Lewis, and Grog Boy himself, Samwell, from Eagle Beak Brewing. And even more exciting, later in the show, we're going to be drinking a homebrew made by the King of the North using yeast from Wildflower. And even better, you've got some too, and we get to share that together. How cool is that?
I'm excited.
Yeah.
That's super rad that Sam could send that down. Like,
It's huge.
So last minute, and he was sending me messages today, and he's like, "Dude, I'm low-key super nervous." And I was like, "Don't be. Like, you're an awesome brewer. It's exciting to do this." And I thought he would say no, so I was super stoked.
I mean, we could end up just like hardcore railing on the podcast.
Yeah,
but no,
of course we won't do that. But,
yeah, I'll just send him an email later. But I have seen the packaging, and he's already done it. I have full confidence in this beer. I'm looking forward to enjoying it.
I'm really excited about it. So, what are you drinking, Topher?
Sparkling water.
Oh, delicious.
The man after my own heart.
We are big fans of the sparkles.
Yeah,
actually.
My daughter is not so into it. She calls it the spicy water.
So does my daughter.
Oh,
sparkling water has to hurt the throat a little bit.
It does. And if I'm not in pain, I don't want it.
My daughter loves it. She prefers it at dinner, which we're probably going to find out in like 5 years. You probably shouldn't feed your kids carbonated water or something like that, you know. Mm. But no, so
it's
no,
about the same as cigarettes or dairy, like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All the same. No, I've been trying to, you know, keep it to weekends and.
I tried that for a bit.
Oh, to be honest, as you guys probably know, if you have kids, our eldest is 8 months and is 8 months old now. And I reckon last week he started sleeping through the night, and so we're still
rough.
In that weird position where it's like. You don't want to have a glass of wine or a beer because you're like, shit, I could be awake in an hour, you know, and this would really hurt in the morning, even if you just had one. And so we still haven't ventured back into the middle of drinking too much.
I'm not going to get into my drinking habits with kids around. I just push through it, man. It's fine.
I'm not going to tell you that my kid sleeps 12 hours every night forever.
So. And I'm not going to tell you that my 2-year-old froths on a dank neeper. I said I'm not going to tell you that.
Yeah.
Of course, today's episode wouldn't even be recorded if it wasn't for our lovely friends at Carlin Cellars who are supporting us through the Time and Barrel series. So we do thank them for the love. It's been challenging for us, I guess, because it's such a different realm of what we usually record, and you know, our guests that we talk to, and it's been very eye-opening.
Let's be honest, mate, you were straight up nervous about tonight.
Every Time and Barrel series episode.
When we first started this, you were like, imagine one day if we could have Wildflower on.
That's true.
We're just two blokes in a shed, just like you guys.
That's
so true right now.
Yeah, exactly.
There are clouds driving in the garage.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we do thank Carwin, of course. There's a couple more episodes left of the series, and so awesome to have Topher on, of course. But we also got a lovely support from our patroneers as well, and including a new Patreon, and her beers.
Welcome, Emily.
Gotta hit that wow.
Welcome to my tier, Emily. It's so good to have you in there in Ahab's Whale Hunters.
It is good to have her. I think she might have got convinced when I dropped that little note about the custom glassware, but we can't speak about that.
That's true. So obviously if you join up with the Patreon, you get to find out what episodes are coming up. You get a chance to ask, you know, brewers the questions that might be asked on the show. Little discount codes as of, you know, last week. We've had Van Diemen check out a 15% discount code on his online store, which is awesome.
The entire range.
I've seen a few people picking up the new Spontaneous Ferment with mulberries, so that's cool to see.
Yeah, and obviously we're working on some new merch and cool little things that we're really excited about and we've wanted to do for a long time. So it's awesome with the you know, the support coming through that we can actually now do those things. So it's really cool.
Official friends of the show.
Absolutely. So without with the plug out of the way, let's hit some beer news, shall we?
All right. So some interesting news this week. So Ballistic Brewing have had the Twang Brambleberry recall. So it's a product recall due to suspected re-fermentation in their cans, and they've recalled kegs too. Ballistic are doing the right thing here. That's not why we're bringing it up. But This begs the question, do we think there'll be more issues like this coming with the unfermented juice side of beer that's already been happening in America? We're pushing more into smoothies and fruity sours, like we're pushing really hard in that direction. So is this going to be happening more, do you think?
Yeah. I think we are, I want to say longer, but maybe 12 to 18 months away from like people trying to emulate like the 450 North Florida Vice stuff and just seeing like huge amounts of unfermented fruit going into cans, getting warm and popping off.
Yeah,
I think it is going to happen. We follow the US in so many trends. Why wouldn't we follow this one?
Yeah, that's true.
Because it's an awful trend. That's why we should follow.
But the people want it.
It is an awful trend.
People want smoothies.
Yeah, exhale. That's all you need to say.
Yeah. Yeah. But Trillium, our lovely Trillium, even went as far as saying it was the customer's fault for not storing the beers cold. Oof. Putting that back on the consumer, I mean, it's a little rough.
I did see that post on their Twitter saying that, you know, it only exploded because you didn't treat it right. And I was like, oh.
You don't know the journey it's taken to get to that fridge that it should probably be in. But
I just think maybe don't send people grenades.
Yeah. It's also
very
shelf stable products are excellent.
Yes. Yeah. Can't get around them enough. Don't want a surprise, generally.
Yeah. All right, we'll move on. There have been a few government grants handed out in WA to some indie brewers like Rocky Ridge and Beaten Track, with the grants worth a total of $400,000 to help them expand. That's pretty freaking rad. So Rocky Ridge are looking to double their fermentation space, which will hopefully mean more Rocky Ridge on the East Coast.
That would be lovely.
We got some Rocky Ridge in our pack from one of our beautiful Patreons that was sent through this week. Actually, we got a plethora of WA beers.
A plethora.
We got a massive amount of WA beers, so we should be hooking up some WA episodes real soon.
Yeah, friend of the show, Rob Stu. Thank you, sir. And some more news. Not sure if you're up to date with what Wildflower are up to, but Topher, we saw a picture of on your gram of some tinnies. What's going on there, man?
Well, we canned some beer, so that's pretty exciting. Since we started, I mean, I've often gone to a tinny in terms of, you know, I love the format because of how sort of portable they are and how, you know, you can just take them wherever you want to go. And really, when we think about Saison, when we think about the kind of the styles of beer that we make and maybe some of the traditions upon that, like building upon that, a lot of those beers weren't necessarily meant to be consumed years after they were put into bottle. So, you know, putting this against something like Lambic, separating those two things, you know, these were beers that were made for a time and consumed within a reasonable amount of time. And one of the things I've been keen on is making some beer that is younger and being able to put it into can and being able to make it transportable. So you can take it on a hike, you can take it, you know, wherever you like, wherever people like to go with their cans. That's up to you. I don't know. all that's to say, I just think they're badass. I think they're pretty fun. And so what we've been working on, and I think really, really slowly and really iteratively, I've kind of worn down the guys at East Coast Canning enough to say, would you be willing to can some mixed culture beer? And so, you know, after my years of asking them, I finally just said, guys, what's it going to take? Like, I've got friends in the States who have purchased, you know, full new seals kits for the mobile canning lines. So every soft part difference, like a separate set of soft parts for the machine that the mixed culture breweries use, and that's totally separate from the clean brewers. Do you think something like that could work? Or
in the same way Josh from Black Arts essentially did that on his beer de coupage.
Yeah, I think so. Josh actually was there the day that we canned, and I don't remember. We spoke about that, but I'm not gonna I can't remember exactly his process, so I don't want to say now what he did do on that with it.
He just said it was a massive pain in the ass.
Okay, yeah.
and took a lot of convincing of East Coast bosses.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess similar to that. So we went ahead and purchased them an entirely mixed culture soft seals kit, and they came in with the line stripped down, so just the metal parts, and spent hours, I'm talking hours, putting every single little valve, everything that touches beer and is not metal, was replaced. We packaged our beer, and then so we canned it off, and then they took all of the soft seals off again and took the machine away. And it's been in quarantine now for 2 weeks. They've been just like a Kenji Tazi or something like that. It's been in quarantine. They've rebuilt it, done some tests and things like that, and aren't going to send it back into the fleet until all of us, you know, ourselves included, are happy with those tests. Early indications, and everyone's kind of, they're professionals. I mean, they're really good at what they do.
Yeah, they're good operators.
East Coast. And so we kind of have done this little project together. You know, it might be a once-off thing. Maybe it's something we'll continue to do in the future. But we kind of took this together just to, I mean, I was really keen to do it because it's pretty rare worldwide to have mixed culture beer in can. That's not pasteurized. And even mixed culture beer in can, that is pasteurized. I mean, either way. I mean, Jolly Pumpkin cans come out here a little bit. Mm. Oh, I don't know if the cans come out here. I haven't seen a can out here. But
yeah, I haven't seen a can yet.
Yeah. They do it in the States, but it's pretty rare to see, and I think it's really exciting because, I mean, if you come to our cellar door or if you look at our beer online, like, we do our best to make, we're a really, really small team, and we work pretty hard, and we do our best to make our beer really affordable, and we do that by keeping a small headcount, and I think, I wanted to do the beer in cans just to be able to make that one little thing, maybe that a little bit more affordable now, like, because of the packaging cost as well.
Do you think that'll lead to like an approachability too, and like encourage people to not hoard wildflower, like have it as a everyday wildflower drink?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I've always said, like, please don't wait for a special day. Like Tuesday, you've had a tough day, or you've had a great day, just open a beer, you know? Like, we've put that time in, like, it's ready to drink when we sell it to you. If you choose to set it down in your cellar, like, so be it, no worries. But don't feel inclined. And I guess it's just a kind of another thing that would help kind of break down the barrier of mixed culture beer being something that's kind of ethereal, or maybe some present for the vanguard. It's just beer, right? It's just fucking beer at the end of the day.
Yeah.
When I want to open a barley wine, it's just beer. Just let me open it.
Sure, yeah. But, like, I think, I mean, honestly, like, pre-1890, you know, mid-1890s, all beer was mixed culture beer, and that's the majority of, you know, beer's history is not monoculture beer. And so let's not get hung up on these, like, you know, old school practices being not being able to be available. You know, I think when people ask me about what we do, I think one of our goals is to make our beer, like, affordable, approachable. It sounds like such a marketing thing, but and available. Like, I want it to be at your bottle shop when you decide to go foray into drinking wild ales. We do our best to do that. I mean, that's why we don't do, you know, insane, like, different labels every single time. We kind of value consistency and you know, sameness, I think, over one-offs. Like, I want people to know what they're getting when they go to the shop. And also, it takes away a little bit of that, you know, FOMO of, oh gosh, there's a new blend, or there's a new bottle, there's a new can. So I have to get it. It takes that away. So it means that it can be just there on the shelf, a cool wine, you know, like it. I reckon if you went down there right now, it would be
very good friends of the show. It is. They do have a few wildflower there at the moment.
And that's what we want. Like, imagine you told your friend, hey, like, there's this thing, you might like it. And then they went to the store and they go, oh yeah, sorry, you've got to be, you know, in queue after the full moon. And the clock strikes three times. It's like, come on, like, it's just beer.
That's how Ali normally likes his beer.
Yeah, that's true.
one per person, line up.
You know what though? Like, you're so right, Topher. It's so nice getting to tell.
Oh no, I don't like what you're about to say, Ian, because you just love drinking as much as possible. I do. Every night.
No, it's not about me. It's actually really freaking nice being able to tell, like, any one of my mates who aren't as geeky and nerdy as me, but you know, I know they might like a sour. I'm like, hey, you should just drop in a cool wine, pick up a gold or an amber. It's delicious. Mm. And they can just do that. They don't need to worry about whether it's on the shelf or not.
We gave people amber. I had a birthday bottle share on Saturday night, and you know that was a lot of flexi stuff. But we gave people amber early on, and then we had Hive amber as well. Mm-hmm. And some of the people, Hive was fantastic.
Yeah, I wish there was delicious. More of that.
We did those side by side, and the people who weren't into mixed culture and, you know, a relatively new in beer were just like blowing away. And I was like, they're like, oh, is this one of the hard ones to get? I'm like, no, you can, you know, the amber, you can go pick it up right now. So it was good. It was fun.
Yeah, that's the goal. That's awesome to hear. Cause like I'm driven by beer breweries like DuPont and Orval, you know, focused, consistent. Like you just know what you're gonna get when you open those beers. I mean, unless the Orval is like 5 years old, but you still know what you're gonna get, you know. So anyway, all of this has to say, like, there is kind of, you know, in our ethos, and I guess we can talk about this later. But like in terms of what Chris and I do, my brother-in-law and I do, and what we want the brewery to be focused on, accessibility is a really big part of that. And you know, kind of removing the need for anxiety about tasting a certain beer or not. There'll be another one, you know. That's not to say don't hop online and buy my beer when I release it. Certainly you can definitely kind of go do that, but if you miss out on it, like, it's okay, like, relax, you know, just don't go sit in the shop anyway. So what we've put into can is very specific to that as well. I'm totally giving you guys a scoop here. This is exciting.
Oh, we love scoops.
So what we've put into can very much follows along with that. So have any of you guys been to Orval? Like, have you been to the monastery?
No.
Wish I could.
Belgium beer trip is something I have not done.
No, I've been to Belgium, but I haven't had a beer trip there.
Oh man, it's the best.
Once we can travel again, we'll just put it on the list.
Yeah, exactly. Truth. Chris and I will come with you. You guys can take the flight from Tassie and we'll go over.
Done.
Sydney.
We'll call you up.
Sure. Sounds good to me. So at the monastery, you can... So they make two beers. They make Orval and they make Petit Orval. And Petit Orval is served... It's served with like a greenish label. So the Orval that we know is the one that they make 99.9999% of volume.
Yeah.
But they make a 3.5% version just for if you go on retreat there. But also there's a cafe just at the outside, like right at the gate as you go into the monastery. And they serve it there, Petit Orval. They call it...
Like a sexy table beer.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly what it is. And so since we began the brewery, we've always made a table beer, in that idea of like a low alcohol session beer that you can have, you know, at any time. And we've always kept that to the brewery. I've always been really anxious about the market, like just totally rejecting a 2.9% beer, being like, what is this trash, and throwing it, you know, I want more alcohol, which
needs more potentially energy.
Which is potentially exactly what will happen. But it's been nice bringing people to the brewery and explaining that tradition of beer being a preserved food, you know, rather than an inebriant. That's what it started off as, is a food preservation technique.
Wow, I feel bad because I went to your brewery and just got lit on Noel instead of having this delicious table beer.
How disrespectful.
I know.
A young
age. Well,
you had the Hives on and I was just straight into those, and then there was Noel and that was great. So I just, you know.
I believe in Australia it's called Noel, mate.
No, it's Noel.
Oh, God.
I do. I call it Noel.
I interrupted.
That's okay.
There's a little cheeky Noel up next to the case of Trevor Pills in my fridge.
What? Can you just stop?
Well, I mean, you missed out, but good news is that finally, like, and also I spent a little bit of time in a brewery in Esquebec in kind of northeastern France, just outside of Lille, and they make a table beer in collaboration with or maybe it was a response collaboration, I'm not sure, but in collaboration with Jester King. So Jester King's, no, they make a beer in collaboration with Jester. Jester King has Le Petit Prince, which is their table beer, 2.9%. Thierrier has their Le Petit Princesse, I think. And I'm not sure the alcohol on that one, but it's low. And then so I've worked at both those breweries. I spent a little bit of time at Jester King as well. And kind of out of respect to them and homage to them as well, we serve that. And so we've kept it at the brewery this whole time. And we have people often kind of emailing, asking for bottles and things like that. And I've loved that. I've loved building like a little bit of understanding around why we make a beer like that and what that means to me and or what that you know kind of means in the market. Like I think it's an important thing to have low alcohol beers in the market and really tasty ones, because you know, like we were saying before, like, you know, there's some fathers in the room, or you know, we don't have to get drunk when we're drinking. You know, the fact that beer is like a mild inebriant is like in some ways counterproductive in my mind. I wish I could taste all that stuff and not get drunk, to be honest.
Especially on doing it like a big tasting day and a big paddle, like a blending session.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, we don't blend the table beer, but that would be, it's, yeah. Fatigue sets in after about 100 samples, I reckon. We're pretty tired when we're doing those.
That's
but
impressive.
Anyway, I think they're important. And I think in Australia, particularly, it suits our climate. Like when it is super hot, you want to just keep, I find Australians, I mean, I've lived here for 11 years, but I find Australians like drinking a hell of a lot more than they like getting drunk. And some people really like getting drunk. That's fine. It's your prerogative. But within my mates and the people that I know, I mean, it's a social thing. It doesn't. And so the consequences of that don't necessarily need to be that you have to be carted home. So I think they're really important. And like Colonial's small beer has often been something that's in my fridge. And there's a couple other like really, really good low alcohol beers out there. So we canned the table beer, and I think that's what we'll keep it to be honest. So there was this like epiphany, this like axis that you cannot deny, which is that a 2.9% beer in a 440 ml can is exactly one standard drink. So we had to do it.
Awesome. There's gonna be a lot of people super excited about that though.
I'm really excited because I'm really excited to finally offer it outside of the brewery. It's been something it's hard to put in a 750 ml bottle, and then you know the glass is really expensive, the cap is really expensive, and the shipping is really expensive of that. So it's been something that's been tough to put into a 750 ml bottle and price according to what it is.
I think too though, that philosophy of like you know making it approachable and the can feels very approachable, like. That's the same argument that's happened recently of people putting barrel-aged stouts in cans and people are saying, oh, I'm just, you know, I bought four of them, but I just ripped through them because it doesn't feel as special. But
it doesn't feel like, you know, it should be in the cellar.
The beer is exactly the same thing. And, you know, you can also pack it in, pack it out on a walk, you know, in nature or kayaking or whatever you're doing. So it's really cool.
Yeah. So on top of that, the other kind of delineation that's marked by the can, and I think something that I'm really proud to make a big fuss about, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but I'm really proud to make a big fuss about, and this will be, you know, stark, markedly different packaging format. So it's something we've never done, but on top of that, it's a certified organic product. And to my knowledge, that when it's released, I mean, I'm not hugely into superlatives, but I'm proud to say that it's probably the only organic beer made of Australian malt that I know of at the moment, and I can't wait for it to be one amongst hundreds, to be honest. But I think I'm really excited to be able to get into people's hands drinkable organic, like certified organic mixed culture beer that's affordable. I mean, like that's you know, if I'm going to be a saison brewer, if I want to be doing what I want to do, and you know, like if I want people to understand that mixed culture beer isn't something that needs to sit in your cellar, then I want it to be that. I want it to be like the full deal with the organic certification as well. So certification is not something we necessarily aimed for particularly since we started, but it's certainly been as we've worked harder with the growers and that we work with here in New South Wales, it's become something that I want to kind of honour the effort that they're putting into it. And that someone, if they don't know me or they don't listen to a podcast about how our grain is farmed, that they still would have the you know, I wouldn't be using the organic word with a smoke and mirrors. It's like, no. Yeah, we're open to be audited. So it will be. I mean, look, it's re-fermenting now, and I think it'll probably, we'll let this first one hang around for sort of 4 to 6 weeks in can, which is our normal kind of 4 to 6 weeks re-fermentation for that beer before we serve it. Whereas most of the barrel-aged beer gets a few months in bottle. But I think hopefully September we should see that, unless there's something drastic that goes on, and I'll let people know. I don't know what would happen, but the carb looks good and everything's on point. So hopefully that should be, it should be in September, just as it starts warming up. Probably not for you Tasmanians, but for us Northerners, warming up. And so, I mean, look, I wouldn't, I'll say right now, never say never, because I've been doing this long enough. Well, I haven't been doing it super long, but I know just not to shut the door on any opportunity, because if push came to shove and it was shut the business or put the beer in cans, I'd put the beer in cans. I have no intention of putting anything that goes into oak into can.
Yeah.
It's a different
offering, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. But by and large, we will still heavily be a bottling brewery. But could just be a bit of fun.
Well, that is a massive scoop for us. we weren't sure if you would even let us talk about it, so thank you for sharing that.
I'm the fool that put it on Instagram.
Well, we will talk about a bit how open you are on your blog and Instagram in the main section. So while Ali plays the jingle, I will open up a special beer. So while we start off the actual portion of this interview, very, very pleased to open up a bottle of Eager Beak Brewing Co., which is Sam the King in the North's homebrew set up for now, but, you know, potentially a gypsy brewer in the future, who knows? I just think from based on the beers he sent me so far, he kind of has to. So this is a bottle of Easy Does It, which is an Australian wild ale with Sars and Motueka, which is using yeast from Wildflower, which is super exciting.
And Topher should have a bottle as well. Has he gone to grab it? He's got it.
Do you open it now?
Yeah, go for it.
And I'm interested now.
We haven't poured it yet.
So King has sent us the recipe as well. So 50%, so for the beer nerds listening, 50% Vitamin Pills, 28% Simpsons Pale, 10% flaked wheat, 10% flaked oats, 2% acidulated, bittered with Sars and Tetnang to 18 IBUs. Whirlpool with Motueka and Sars, which is very much a Wildflower thing. Built up a starter from the culture. Brewed in March. It's just started conditioning, so he bottled some up specifically for this show so we could drink it and you could drink it. And I'm actually genuinely most excited to drink this.
Pour it in
the glass.
He's already
in your glass.
Yeah, we're going to get in the glass. We're just watching this little...
Remember, I was saying I wasn't doing much midweek drinking, and then I got an excuse, so straight into it.
Well, I mean, this is a fairly unique beer to drink on our show, and I think maybe only the second homebrew we've ever drunk. Just having a frothy little pour over the top.
Really,
like the conditions worked well, Sam.
Yeah,
well,
that's true. Awesome of you to send him some culture as well, Topher. That's really, really cool.
It's in all of our bottles. It comes with the package.
Yeah.
I like the way you're doing.
I did know that, and I just did a complete retail.
No. We also, each year we have a day. We've done it 3 years at the brewery. We kind of talk about making mixed culture beer, talk about making beer from your backyard. And this year that focus was really shifted towards regenerative agriculture and sustainable farming, and when it comes and how that, you know, plays into the beer thing. how that plays into beer, like really marketing beer as an agricultural product. And we call that Waratahe. It sort of surrounds the release of our entirely New South Welsh beer. And on that day, we often give away. I mean, we have loads of culture, so we put it into vials and give it away to anyone. And if people email me at the time, I mean, it's got stuff there. So if someone gets something online, maybe they buy a bottle, or just drop us an email and say, hey, can I have a little vial of culture? Yeah, no worries. We'll drop it in the mail. Have fun.
Yeah, so cool. We really love how you encourage that sort of, I guess, you know, brewing, trying that sort of stuff, and, you know, especially the blog articles. So one of my favorite things to read through is the new tasting notes for Gold and Amber. And this morning I was reading St. Thomas, I think, from memory. And we were all talking about it, a bunch of other brewers, ourselves and the Step Brewers boys, about how open you are about, you know, process and, like, you know, what happened with last year's batch with the de-stemming and things. And it's really refreshing to see, I guess, that approach from a brewery who's, widely considered the best, you know, the best in the business. Was that method of always sharing online and sort of promoting the growth of others always part of your business plan and your ethos?
I mean, I'm just glad to hear someone reads them, to be honest.
I think more people.
Sometimes I wonder. I send it out into the ether, and they're just gone. I'm like, oh well. I don't really do any like data capture on that. I see if anyone watches it, or if it says that there's been visits to the site, I just assume it's bots, trolling or something. So no, it's great. I mean, sometimes we put the posts up before the release because we attach those to like the email that we send to accounts like Cool Wine, to the bottle shops and restaurants that sell our beer, so they can read the full story if they like. And I have often wondered. It's funny that you're reading it, because I have often wondered. I'm like, oh, I wonder if people read that before, or maybe they wait until they're. Anyway, you've answered a great question of mine by that. So. That's good. Hopefully you enjoyed the 3,000 words on Thomas this year.
I like to get nerdy. I like that it covered up to a second Instagram post. We were all sending it around this morning.
I was like, that's only the first section of the whole blog post, as you've already seen. Tasting notes, production notes, it's all to come.
Now, speaking of tasting notes, what are you thinking of Sam, the King in the North's beer?
I think it's excellent, as you heard me say initially. I mean, it reminds me a lot of, it's got an international vibe. So there was a beer, the Saison Beer de Garde, Farmacelle Appreciation Society, which is a Facebook group dedicated to all the things that it says it is. They put together a recipe a couple of years ago now, 2018. Members did and kind of voted for different things, and then a handful of breweries, I think it was 7 or 8 of us, Isaac will be able to tell me how many of us there were, but brewed the same recipe, and we all used our house culture. We fermented in oak, and we all tried to use kind of local grain, but the hops were chosen, and it was Motueka and Halotar Blanc heavy on the nose. So I'm actually getting like Halotar Blanc on there, like this similar like Venice Sauvignon characteristics on the nose. And it also reminds me, like, there's just that bit of like herbal back end that we get off of young Gold. Like when Gold tastes young, now the palate reminds me much more of international, because it's not it's all, I think as you read off, I think all that grain was malted. I'm not sure if there's any unmalted. So it has that kind of little bit of malted. All malted, yeah.
Yeah, so...
really beautiful, zippy, kind of really crushable. It's flawless.
It's pretty fucking delicious.
It's stunning. More,
It's got such a, like a zippy, like almost like a light, like farmhouse sherbet here.
I was about to say the same thing. It's got like lemon sherbet for people playing.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, when you're sucking on a lemon, it's got that little... I'm licking my lips and I've got that
On a lemon, are you, mate?
Yeah, I love it.
You hipsters.
But it's not, I mean...
Not it's sour, but it's just got that... Just that good citrus.
It's
like,
super delicate.
Mm.
Imagine that in cans, Jans. I mean, would you not pick that up?
It actually reminds me a lot of the vibe of it, of a canned beer I had the other day from someone will correct me here. It was Crooked Stave. the citrus saison they have in cans that's going around Australia right now.
Oh yeah,
it's like a
that was Crooked Stave.
Yeah, it's like a fresher, zippier version of that.
This is really good.
Yeah,
it's almost it's really really.
I want there to be more. Culture, is there more?
Yeah.
There isn't. There's a little bit of bottle culture in the bottom. If you wanna ruin your your delicious pour that I gave you there, this is fantastic. I think Sam should be super freaking proud.
I want to pay money to have more of this.
Well, luckily Sam sent us about six other beers along with this.
I want six more of this.
It's awesome. Thank you so much, Sammy, for sending this down. It's awesome. It was so cool we got to open it on the show as well.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely well done, Sam. It's really well executed.
Yeah, and not just saying that, we would tear you apart because you're a good friend of ours.
So without any kind of further ado, I guess, Topher, let's start at your start. Where does your brewing story begin? Can you give us a bit of your origin, and in particular, what brought you to focus on mixed culture?
Sure. So I turned 30 this year, so I was born... I won't go all the way back. I'm originally from the States, moved out here in 2009 full time. And I come from a family of kind of like hands-on kind of people. Family's a lot of engineers, but growing up, my mom, she still is like a really great cook, particularly baking. And I'm from a family of six kids, five boys and one girl, so I'm the youngest. And my mom fed us majorly from a little quarter acre plot in our like very much suburban setting. Like, so we didn't have much of a yard, like a backyard. Mom just grew heaps and heaps and heaps. She's an excellent gardener. And we always made things from scratch at home. There was never a packet cake ever around. Every Thursday was chocolate chip cookies. When you get home from school, it was pretty good. To be honest, looking back at it now, we can now talk about what the standard American diet, like SAD, we call it the SAD diet, what that's done to diabetes, and particularly in the States. And it is pretty sad, to be honest. And I think a lot of that you see here in Australia as well, just this convenience, cooking and what kinds of things are packed into. Are packed into a lot of processed foods. Anyway, so you see these things that are packed into a lot of processed foods. Anyway, growing up, we did things from scratch. We always like fixed our own stuff and made food from scratch. Never a plumber or an electrician. My dad's an electrical engineer, so we just fixed it. You just kind of look at a problem and you solve it. And looking back, I think I've carried that through parts of my life. In different endeavors that I've kind of taken on, I'm always someone that likes to start from the basic building blocks and then kind of work from there and kind of re-engineer things maybe a different way or maybe not the way that's most commonly applied, or a lot of times look at things and how they were traditionally done before some of the ease of some of the processing aids that we have now and sort of every type of manufacturing or cooking or whatever it is. So throughout university, you know, I was been into shoemaking, you know, starting with straight leather. I didn't get into like tanning leather. That would have been a whole new thing, but, starting with leather and building, you know, 3D forms, you know, like wrapping leather around a last and making shoes. That was something I was into for a while because I thought that was really interesting. I still do.
Are you like a serial hobbyist? Like I'm starting to see.
I'm massive.
I'm starting to see comparisons between this everyone at this table and you already.
The potting wheel outside. So I was really into. I've been into ceramics and still am. I really, really enjoy throwing pottery. But it's a little bit colder in Sydney right now, and the wheel's outside, so I haven't thrown in a little bit. Bread making, you know, you name it. Serial hobbyist. And so when it came to brewing, like when I finally got stuck into this in uni, because, you know, you thought it was a great way to make cheap booze, which is totally not true, because you spend a lot more money homebrewing than you do if you just went to go buy the beer. But as I got into homebrewing through uni, I really enjoyed the hospitality factor of beer. So I loved the sense that I could do something on my own that I like to perfect or like to work on, but it could be shared with a large group of people. And when you think back to, you know, my upbringing with a large family and someone who cooks a lot, dinners and parties and, you know, having people over, hospitality, like that genuine sense of Southern hospitality was a really big part of who we are and I really enjoyed how we could kind of, I could kind of foster that and kind of, express that in something that I also love to do on my own with brewing. And so as I was finishing my degree, I studied physics at Sydney Uni. And as I was finishing my degree, I was kind of like doing a little bit of research for the CSIRO and then decided I'll just do the research part-time. And two friends of mine were starting a brewery, which is now Batch Brewing Company, Andrew and Chris, who were other American expats living in Sydney playing lacrosse. We all played lacrosse. Which is like this funny American sport that everyone knows from American Pie. But it's a great sport. And there's like this great, there's just a little group of expats that played it down the rocks in Sydney. And they started up in this brewery and I was doing a lot of home brewing at the time and I was doing a little bit of brewing at Flat Rock Brew Cafe, which is this great little brew cafe in Narrabeen on the North Shore of Sydney, where it was like cask ale pints and curry nights every Thursday, like a very English kind of vibe. And started working for Batch and was great. Like Chris became very busy running the business and Andrew became very busy selling the beer. And I got to get really busy making kind of whatever we wanted to make. And so had a really great introduction into professional brewing where once again, I got to kind of teach myself. I mean, Chris was there and Chris was also a home brewer and more advanced than me in terms of professional brewing, but just really got to learn by getting my feet absolutely like soaked, like definitely jumped in head first into that. But, you know, the ethos of Batch then and still now was to be able to create new things all the time. And so was given that opportunity to do that at the brewery. So we got to create a bunch of different random crazy beers. Some of them still exist now, and a lot of them have probably met their natural end that I made at the time. But increasingly, like throughout my progression as a brewer, and I think as I started to become more interested in kind of other areas of fermentation and food a lot more, food origin, a couple things started to gnaw at me, not necessarily about what I was doing at Batch, but I think about the industry as a whole and what I was kind of contributing to that industry. Foremost among them was this idea of like local, and this idea of breweries being local by nature of where they are and not necessarily by what they're using. It wasn't a necessity then, like it is now, I think in a lot of ways to be using, state ground barley or, hops from your own country. It was really, I think at that time, we're talking 2014, 2015, breweries were really more focused on kind of replicating styles from elsewhere. I mean, outside of Stone & Wood, who's completely visionary on their own track the whole time, which is awesome. They were kind of like reappropriating styles that were probably maybe more appropriate in other areas of the world. And I didn't really like that. I thought to myself, okay, I've moved halfway across the world. I'm living here, making beer in this like incredibly rare and unique country. How can I make beer that maybe expresses that more? And so the natural progression is to say, well, I need to make beer with ingredients from here. So there's four ingredients in beer, barley, well, sort of malted cereal or unmalted cereal, so cereal, hops, water, and yeast,
and lactose for all the hypey boys. Obviously.
God, adjuncts are not a thing. Essentially, fruit, but that's it. God, that beer's good.
Right, it's
it just gets like fruitier and more.
It's
like,
just total
tasty on the palate.
Is it the Motueka bringing that like limey sherbety?
Yeah,
so good.
It's such a good hop.
It's so good.
really annoying, as I will have to depart from it at some stage to continue my dogmatism of only using New South Wales ingredients. But day will come.
We'll bring that up later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I'm talking about now, is the sense that, you know, when we started the brewery, I said, okay, well, let's try to make beer with what we have. And what we have, let's draw a map. We'll draw a circle around New South Wales and we'll call that, you know, our home. It's a pretty big geographic area. So within that geographic area at the time, we were able to find, you know, cereal that was being malted to use. And we were able to find yeast and, of course, water. So, I mean, water, we're in Sydney, so we just use Sydney filtered water. For our barley, we've always worked with Stu at Voyager Craft Malt. So he's out in Witten, so sort of Riverina, New South Wales, and he malts. He was then malting barley off his parents' property, the Schooner varietal, some 70s, you know, heritage varietal barley that we were using. Only for our beer, like exclusively for our beers, completely non-commoditized malt. Hops, however, were the one that kind of held us back and still continue to now in terms of being entirely state-based. But we've been since stayed up working with Ryfield Hops in Benboka, New South Wales, so just in the Bega Valley. And this year would have been their sort of first commercial harvest, and they would have been able to supply us for the year. Not that we're huge, just that they were really growing. But unfortunately, I think a lot of people would know by now that the coupling of the drought and then the bushfires wiped out their entire crop after, you know, the crazy amounts of investment from them. So really excited to hopefully, they're getting rain now. It was raining a lot over the past few days in Sydney, and this is the first major rainfall event in about 18 months. So I'm really, really, really happy that that's happening and their DMs can get filled. But anyway, the main thing that was going to drive our process the most, simply our flavor profile and also then influence the equipment that we purchased in order to make our beer, was our yeast. And so I wanted to bring back, you know, going back to this idea about using things from here, I wanted to play around with or kind of explore the possibilities of using native yeast, you know, yeast from your own backyard. So I often describe what we do as kind of like the sourdough bread of beer making. You know, if you started your own culture from your windowsill, that culture has, you know, yeast and bacteria from the grain, from your hands, and from the air. In many ways, mixed culture beer is similar in terms of how it can be influenced by the environment, and there's lots of different ways to capture and harvest yeast from your environment. And that's a whole new can of worms and rabbit hole if you want to go down that one. But the one that I kind of decided to play around with start our house culture with was by foraging yeast off of native flowers here in New South Wales. Being an outsider to the country, I was and still am pretty enamored by the variety and rarity of the flora here in Australia. And so, you know, I had this idea that potentially if the flora is so so unique, and you know, the flora has been developing independently for such a long time from the rest of the world, as this, you know, Gondwanan arc was ripped off the rest of Pangaea, you know, however many millions of years ago, potentially the microflora would share some of those, you know, unique characteristics that maybe we could express in our beer, and maybe that would be something that would be, that would give our beer that sense of locality that I was searching for.
So we want to talk more about microcultures and like you capturing these bacterias in a moment, but Ali's got a ripper for you.
Yeah, I'll finish with my story.
Finishing your story.
No.
You're going ahead.
I mean, what led you to set up in Marrickville? I mean, some would argue it's not really where you would expect like a brewer to be in that particular style. I mean, dealically a farmhouse, but does it even matter?
No, it's twofold. One is the fact that we don't actually have a brew house. Like I don't know. Set of equipment to turn malted barley and hops into wort or unfermented beer.
We've only had one brewer on the Time and Barrel Series show that actually has owned a brew house, so it's
Well, who's it? Van Diemen does?
Yeah, so we had Will on last week. He was the first one who actually owned a brew house. But, I mean, he didn't start in the segment that you guys are in now. Everyone else is brewing somewhere else, so.
Right, yeah. He's been making Hedro for years, though. Like, I remember going to Tassie on my honeymoon in 2013 and sourcing bottles of Hedro and wanting to go visit him and then realizing you can't.
Yeah, Will needs, Will needs mate, to finish that. We know he's listening. He always listens to us and gives us shit.
He's such a good mate. I look forward to the time we can go visit him again. But Merrickville, so I don't have my own brew house. Not only did I live in Sydney at the time, I still do, but I'm also, I was working in the area and kind of had made my contacts in the brewing industry here. So if I was going to set up without a brew house, it would be handy to have people who are friends that do have brew houses. So, you know, it was intentional, to make ourselves, to put ourselves in an area where there's lots of different places we can make work, whenever there was time. I mean, the other side of the story is that it was a plan B to be in Merrickville. We had a little piece of land, on the south coast in New South Wales, which is just glorious and so beautiful. We were talking with council about putting a little brewery in, and just didn't fit. We couldn't explain to them what we were doing wasn't Tui's new. this is 2015. We were really pushing stuff uphill. My brother-in-law, Chris, at the time was a lawyer. I mean, he was a lawyer. So my brother-in-law, that is my business partner now, was practicing law and dabbled in a little bit of real estate stuff. And he was just saying, look, like, this is just going to be a real, really long road, if we want to do this. And so we kind of said, all right, well, we'll drop back 10 and punt and we'll do this in the city and we'll start with a little bit, you know, less ideal goals, you know, like, instead of kind of trying to start where we want to finish in terms of, not that I'm saying that's exactly where we want to finish, but at that time, you know, wanting that kind of farmhouse feel, growing our own grain, that kind of thing.
The whole, you know, the whole romantic become, notion of it.
Yeah, exactly what Will's doing, bastard.
there it is.
Instead of, you know, starting at that point, we kind of realized, all right, well, you know, maybe there's something worth working towards, or, you know, we'll learn some things on the way that might influence or inform what we do in the future. So, yeah, being in the city wasn't necessarily the main goal. In fact, a lot of our cultures came from, at the time, my in-laws had a little property down there, and they had an area of it which is totally natural, like, wild rainforest that had never been kind of cleared or anything like that. And a lot of the cultures came from up there. So the brewery still has its, so that started the house culture that we used to ferment our beer. The brewery still has certainly its some sort of spiritual home in the South Coast. We didn't do many cultures, many captures from Merrickville, that's for sure, to start the brewery.
Not even much.
But now I feel like we could. I mean, honestly, I have so much confidence. And without all the planes coming by, it's actually quite beautiful.
Yeah, I haven't been to the cellar door, but I need to go.
So we can't really talk about Wildflower without talking about New South Wales. What drives your love of your home state and your desire to put that terroir on display for everyone?
What drives my love? Well, I think it was probably a lot to do with the fact that I kind of liked, and I still do like operating within a box. You know, like, we, so setting that box was the state. And yeah, I mean, I play outside of it because we've used halotide lock in the past. We use Motueka, we use SARS, but I'm hoping to eventually be able to restrict ourselves to that and be able to play within that space. And I think we can, I think through that, hopefully we'll be able to create, really interesting flavors. It should make us better brewers. I mean, if we call ourselves artisans, we call ourselves like, creators, I mean, a craft or craftsmen or craftspeople, then I think you need to be willing to adjust your methods and your mentality to what you have, not necessarily what you can order off of a list. And that's not a dig at anyone. It's just what I'd like to see kind of going forward. And so I can't I can't want that future without kind of trying to work to it every day. So New South Wales is that kind of boundary for now that we try to play within. I mean, we're so lucky to start at this. I mean, Stu from Voyager was really just starting off at the same time. Mm. So we were able to have these and like start these relationships with people like him from Daydot to really build that, to build the meaning into what we're doing. I don't use the word terroir and associate that with our beer, mostly because I don't farm my own ingredients. And also I think that's probably not the whole story, to be honest. I think that's an excellent, you know, term used in French winemaking for talking about French wine. Hmm. I think that there's better things that we could talk about in beer, and there's better terms that potentially don't exist yet that we can kind of apply to beers that have, you know, Jeff Stuffings from Gesture King always says a sense of place, you know, and terroir, I don't think tells the full story of beer because we have generally ingredients grown in different regions over different seasons, and then terroir doesn't hugely talk about the person that's doing it. And not that I want to overstate what a brewer does, certainly far from the case, but making beer is a pretty manipulative process. I mean, you're harvesting grain, you're wetting it, then you're drying it. You're wetting it with water, then you heat it to cool it down. Then you wet it and heat it again in a mash, and then you boil it again, and then you cool it down, and then you ferment it. Like, there's so many steps in the process. So how can you give the same grain from the same crop to two different brewers and brew two different styles of beer? And can you see that sense of place? And like, can you see that soil? And so it's like, probably not.
So it's like sense of place for wildflower, maybe not the best term, like terroir, sense of place. Maybe it's like a sense of home, like New South Wales is your home and you're trying to champion that.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never thought about it that way, but I like that. Mm. Trademark 2020.
It's all yours. Yes.
Have it. Oh, like, I think all of us, like, I certainly really appreciate that perspective you have. Like,
well, it's such a selling point for brewers in this category, like, you know, using the farmhouse term and like sometimes flippantly and using sense of place as a way to tell stories. But, you know, like you say, you can't necessarily always do that.
I mean, like, it's not something that's reserved for brewers, mixed culture brewers though, either, by no means. I mean, Will has isolated Saccharomyces yeast out of his spontaneous batches, and breweries can do that. And he makes excellent saisons with it, the Max and Edward and those beers. I would really hope that this isn't something that's reserved for brewers using it as a selling point. That's not at all. It just makes sense. You know, like, it just makes sense to use the varietal of barley that grows the best in the soils that you have, and the varietal of hops that does the same. Like, I mean, maybe I'm alone here, but to me, that's just makes sense.
Yeah. How do you go about your spontaneous captures? I mean, is there a controlled element to it, like a scientific method, or is attempting captures until you cultivate something that inspires your palate?
I'll just delineate the terminology quickly. We did do some spontaneous like batches of beer very early on to capture cultures. So when I say spontaneous, I mean we're left out to cool overnight and introduced to the outside air, and the microbes from the outside air being the ones that ferment it. So we did do some of that early. But I feel like maybe what you're getting more towards, maybe what you're asking about, and correct me if I'm wrong, is kind of captures from the wild. Is that like a flower capture? Are you speaking specifically about spontaneous?
No, from the wild. Yeah.
Look, I was out. Not necessarily scientific. I do have a blog post about it. About how we tend to do it. But it's not a science. I've done it enough to kind of have some methods that I think that work. I think starting with like to 4 liters of wort initially for your starting fermentation is a good idea. You don't want to go too small. Headspace generally gets too big, and then you kind of create a lot of acidic characters generally. Also, it's a good idea to get like lots of flowers, like go crazy, like get a good inoculation in there. I often see people kind of trying to isolate off of a single flower, and that's a noble cause. I haven't found it to work for me. I mean, maybe those people have a more scientific understanding as to what they're doing than I do, which is totally possible because I am completely analog. Like, there is no microscope at my brewery. So we go entirely off of taste and smell. So using lots of flowers and lots of culture to initially step it up. And then once that fermentation is going, pitching that active fermentation into a subsequent one. And that just helps, you know, once the fermentation's going, you either have a really heavy Brett fermentation, you have active yeast converting sugar to alcohol, so probably Saccharomyces, but potentially Brett, who knows. Mm. And if you feed that right then and there by pitching it into a larger batch, you know, maybe a 10 times increase, so you have a 4 liter starter, and then you pitch into 40 liters of wort. I mean, I know that's a lot of brewing for home brewers, but you don't have to go that big. But if you feed it, then you're going to be feeding the microbes that are the most active and that are the ones that are multiplying a lot at that time. So you're going to be feeding the more healthy microbes, the ones that you want. And then, you know, do that, let that fermentation stop, and then pitch that again and see if you get similar results, maybe get something different. It's not very scientific. It's pretty anecdotal, like the things that have worked for us, we kind of continue to do.
Is that the point in time where like that starter is getting to a decent size, and say like you scale it back to a homebrew level, it might be, you know, might not necessarily be, you know, 40 liters of wort, but that starter's getting to a certain size, that's when you're, I guess, using your palate to assess whether you've actually picked up some good cultures or not, or if it's like worth pursuing.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of homebrewers might have like a liter or Lemaire flask, so let's do it from there.
Yeah.
Like I would, it's wattle season right now, on the southeastern part of Australia. So, and I'll correct myself there. Wattle can blossom any time of the year. It's pretty cool. It's kind of opportunistic, but particularly where we are in Sydney and out to the mountains, and I know down south, wattles, like specifically the Sydney wattle, like a golden wattle is blossoming right now, and you will know if it's ready to go because you'll walk past it and you won't be able to stop smelling it. It's like so perfumey. Go out, go pick a bunch of that. Don't worry if there's stems or anything like that in there. Shove it into your Erlenmeyer flask and put, like, fill it, like, not quite to the top, maybe leave yourself like a couple centimeters for, like, in the neck with wort, maybe like 10 to 20 BU.
Yeah.
A little bit of bitterness that just like kind of helps stem kind of some of the weirder bacteria that might be in there. And I am like, I have like a 95% confidence that you'll have a nice smelling fermentation in 4 days. Like I have such good results with wattle.
Which is interesting because like you hear about people getting out there and trying to do these same captures and just struggling so hard with it and, you know, producing off flavors, you know, straight away.
Well, if you have any issues, email us info@wildflowerbrew.com and it'll come to me and I'll tell you what I think. Because like I'm super lucky, but I'm definitely not some like fermentation genius. Like it should work. It really should. And this is how fermentations have been done, as I find out, on this continent for millennia.
Mm.
Well, thousands of years, let's say that at least. There's a drink in Western Australia. There was a drink documented called Wayalina. And actually, Max Allen, friend of the brewery, excellent wine writer drinks writer, let's call him, actually, in Melbourne, has just released a new book. And it goes into historical drinks across Australia. And the first chapter deals entirely with pre-settlement drinks. One of them is from your home state, gentlemen. Actually, the Wayalina, I think, is the cider gum tree. Mm. I might be mixing up. And Mangage might be the nectar, the Banksia nectar. But There is a history not only of alcoholic fermentations in Australia before before invasion, but also in Western Australia, a language group that would take Banksia, which are like nectar, like crazy full of nectar. Like if you take a Banksia and shake it onto your hand, you will get like this honey-like sap into your hand. Like I'm not talking a Banksia pod that's gone to seed. I'm talking like
like a fresh
fully Banksia. Colorful. Yeah, yeah. Pop it off, shake it into your hand, taste it. It's amazing. Those pods, those flowers were soaked in water in these kind of like, I don't know how you describe them, like boats in the ground. And then after a few days, the flowers were taken out and new ones steeped in to make this mildly alcoholic drink. So this idea of using flowers to start fermentations is like by no means new. I had no idea that that was the case when I started the brewery, but I'm like so proud to continue like a fermentation tradition in Australia that's has so much more time on like lambic brewing. Lambic brewing is like lame compared to this, like in terms of timing, you know, like this is
I've
really
never,
unique.
Never heard of that. It's very,
it's so cool.
Very cool.
I was sitting at a talk that he was giving in Sydney 2018, and he like pointed me out, I was like, you had no idea, did you? And I was like, nope, that is awesome. I'm also like really proud to be using flowers in that sense, to have stumbled across something that is entirely not new, which is you know, completely it's completely expected when it comes to like the wealth of knowledge when it comes to farming and land management in traditional indigenous practices, but in my mind, like if you're a homebrewer and you're going out and doing it, like tank some Banksia and try it, like tank some wattle and try it. People have been doing this for thousands of years. Like maybe your first one's not too great. I don't know. Try it again. Like maybe you could get something that's really fun. And to be honest, we made a beer last year with. We released a beer last year, which was entirely fermented by wattle. We called it Wattle Drops. And there's a tree that I've got my eyes on that I'll be jumping on in the next couple of weeks to forage a much off of it. So hopefully we'll do it again. But you might be surprised at how clean that beer was. Like if someone had it, you'd recognize it. But it wasn't super bready, wasn't super sour. It was like a really... kind of mild, Belgian-y, beautiful flavor. It was really fascinating. So even if you don't want to make mixed culture beer at home, I'd still recommend trying it. I mean, if you put the beer through enough successive fermentation, so if you just kept feeding it and feeding it and feeding it right when that Saccharomyces was ripping, you might be hearing my son in the background.
Yeah, that's okay.
The boys are quite used to that.
You're not feeding it with acid fermentation dripping, you're going to grow like a lot of Saccharomyces and you're going to get a pretty clean culture.
So I was going to say this next. So how are you actually maintaining those cultures? Like, you know, are you treating them like a sourdough starter? Like once you find a culture from a flower, or is that just for some beers? Are you then having to maintain that in the brewery? Are you trying to keep a certain culture? What's the approach like for wildflower as opposed to someone who's just experimenting?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And this is something that you'll find varies probably the most between mixed culture brewers who have house cultures, like something that they use. The way that you manage that has a massive influence on the outcome, like the flavor of your beer. But that doesn't mean that by following one method, it's going to outcome in a specific way. So what I mean is a sense that I wanted to have a process that was repeatable. Like I wanted to have something that I could manage over and over and over again in order to something I could do over and over again without like too much digging around. So if my process was to always pitch with a single strain of XYZ and then after 3 days and the gravity drops XYZ much, then I hit it with this culture, and then before it goes into barrel, it gets hit with a different. If it was this like multi-step approach, that would be really difficult for me to upkeep. I mean, I wanted to make the flavor profile of the brewery work with how we were able to continually replicate it. So the easiest way to describe this is that some sourdough bakers feed their culture once every second day. Some of them feed it three times a day. They both make bread, right? Both of them, they're going to have different flavors. But that I know which one I'd rather be managing, the once every other day one, rather than the three times a day one, that's for sure. So in that sense, we decided to always do like a full mixed culture inoculation at the start. So our yeast gets a full pitch of yeast, bacteria, bugs all at one go. And so I should say as well, that when we initially did all those flour fermentations and built the culture in kind of 2015, 2016, when I pitched those into the first vat of gold, when we did the first fermentation, that was pitched alongside the DuPont strain. Mm. And so that strain does live in our culture. I mean, now knowing what I know now about flower ferments, I probably didn't need to do that, but it was like a small insurance policy and like a bit of a, something I carried over from like little conversations at Jester King. So that's part of the culture. That's why in the beer it says brewer's yeast, and there's no asterisks on that that ingredient saying that it's an indicator that it's a product of New South Wales. Just so everyone's very clear that the culture was started by flowers. That's where all the bugs come from. There's something like 630 different strains of yeast and bacteria in our culture. As gone on DNA analysis, someone's done that for us. But one of them is certainly not captured from here. There's no smoke and mirrors about what we do. That's what's there. And ever since then, we've just collected the yeast off of the bottom and pitched it back into the top. Mm. So we ferment our beers in a wide stainless steel vessel, like 2,500-liter vessel. And we generally brew once a fortnight, and that is pretty important to keep that schedule going. So once every 2 weeks, the culture's fed, and now it's used to that cycle. So we take culture from a previous fermentation, we pitch it into wort, we let it ferment 10-14 days, yeast and bacteria drops out, the culture drops out. We rack the beer to barrel in the cellar, and where it ages, you know, waiting for blending in some stage in its life. But in the bottom of the tank is the yeast. We remove that yeast, put it into a sterile, like a steam sterilized stainless steel keg. So I treat the yeast as if it was monoculture. We hold that yeast in this like yeast brink until our next fermentation, which is generally only like 1 or 2 days away.
Yeah.
So if it's same day, obviously it won't get refrigerated. If it's next day, it just goes into like a 14 degree cool room, kind of overnight. And then we pitch that culture into the next fermentation, and away it goes. And then what's in the brink, what's still left over in that yeast brink is what we use. It'll be used for like priming, bottles, like tomorrow morning we're packaging Saint-Florent Sauvignon Blanc and Saint-Florent Semillon and St. Walter Black Musket. And both of those beers will get a small amount, like it's sort of an extra 30 mil of fresh yeast from a fermentation that was racked last Friday. So they get some like young, active stuff in the culture, which is why I'm pretty confident that any bottle of ours you'd be able to culture yeast off of it. And that's the exact same culture. We don't use any different priming yeast for that, mostly because I know the attenuation of our beers under the culture that we use to ferment it. Whereas if I added some other culture, we could potentially get over re-fermentation, which is not ideal. So that culture is used for bottling as well. But in the brink, it just stays there until the next time we need to put yeast in it, after you know that next fermentation, and whereby we'll just dump whatever's in there down the drain, which is why I also have culture around all the time for anyone who wants it. goes down the drain, and we replace what's in the brink with the freshly, you know, vacated stuff from the vat. So there's no backup, really. Like the yeast that we use is in the fermentation all the time. Like it just goes into ferment a batch of gold, and then we collect it, we pitch it into the next one, and then comes out, pitch into the next one. And I don't like hold it anywhere. It's not banked anywhere, like lab in a lab or anything like that, because I want that culture to develop. I want it to drift. I enjoy sort of seeing the flavors that come out of it. And we can't call ourselves Wildflower and try to like harbor our yeast, you know, and try to say like, stop there, you know, you've done all the developing you can, like that's not what we're about. And I mean, also there is like a, you know, it lives in the barrels, it's in the bottles. Like we did have like a pretty awful winter in 2018 where the culture like completely stopped fermenting and died, and we had to, I had to like basically spend a lot of time crying and figuring out what I was going to do with my life, because the business that I started was going to go down the drain because we didn't have any yeast left. But was able to recapture and reculture it. So living, going through that, like dumping 8,000 liters of beer in 1 month, wasn't awesome, but it did give me a confidence that like, yeah, we can just start again. You know, it's the same culture, but it has a different composition. And now that's part of what we do, that in 2018, it was rebuilt from kegs and barrels and bottles and all kinds of things. So yeah, it's different, but that's part of the story, you know.
So obviously massive part of what you do is these spontaneous captures, and it evidently helped you rebuild as well. So do you think the idea and the process of these spontaneous captures have been overly romanticized?
I mean, I'm not there around every table or at the bar listening to what is being said, so I'm not sure if they're romanticized at all.
I think maybe a romanticization of the spontaneous captures, like in place,
right?
You know, like my rafters are better than your rafters, type speak.
Oh yeah. Oh yes. I think as far as a bee flies, which is a good few miles, you'd have a pretty similar kind of microbiology of yeast within any one radius. I think there's something special about place. I think there's something special about a place that you ferment in constantly. Like, you know, what the microbiology of our building when we started versus now is certainly different. So I'm not saying it's better than your rafters, Clint, but it's certainly different. That's for sure.
I brew American pails and IPAs, and there are no rafters.
It's certainly different. I mean, I guess I don't see it very romantically, so it's difficult for me to think about what that is. I think of it as like a function. Like that's just where you, I mean, that sounds really dicky, but it's like, no, it's just where you go for yeast.
I think that's something maybe I didn't expect from you, like almost the treatment of fermenting from those flowers is very much functional, and it is very much, it makes sense. It's not to tell a story and to sell a bottle. It's delicious.
Yeah.
We're just going to find ingredients where they are.
It's just grog. It's good grog.
Exactly. It's just, there's a couple of places in the brewery where there's a little Sharpie pen out. You probably wouldn't see it if you just visiting the brewery, but it's just fucking beer is written in a few places. So that, you know, if there's a bad day and you're like, oh, and you just turn around a corner, you're like, actually, yeah, no, what I do is really not that important in the grand scheme of things.
Before we go on to this next question, this will be a short break and listeners will hear the end of the episode.
They will.
Before proceeding to the second part, because we knew that this conversation would go for a while and we hoped that it would. So if you're comfortable, we're just going to press a little jingle and then we're going to continue with a bit of a deeper question I have for you, Topher, while we open Yeah Nah Yeah, which is the best named beer in Australia.
It is. And a few Patreon questions and some other little bits and bobs coming in part two, so it'll be a bit of fun.
Sure.
Very good.
Very good. See you on the next one.